In this episode of PEMBA On Demand, we are releasing our live stream from our November 19th, 2024 show. Our guest today on the show is Dr. Jason Gunderson. Dr. Gunderson is the CEO and co-founder of Cardio One, a company which provides equity and management support for independent cardiology practices. Dr. Gunderson trained in family medicine. His professional journey has taken him in many different directions that he never anticipated. Welcome to PEMBA On Demand. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. I am very excited to welcome you to our podcast. PEMBA On Demand is produced for physicians interested in professional development. We will be discussing a wide range of topics on the podcast. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries who have graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. These physicians will be sharing stories of professional and personal growth, overcoming challenges in their organizations, and discussing key leadership skills they have learned from the MBA program and ongoing professional development. So Jason, welcome to PEMBA On Demand live stream.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. I've been looking forward to this live stream for quite some time now as we have been planning it. So I will turn it over to you and let you kind of go through your presentation. We usually get some very good questions from our listeners, and I have a few questions as well that I thought of as I was reviewing your slide deck. So hopefully we'll get a chance to cover some of those as well.
That'd be great. I'll plan on giving us plenty of time to have questions and dialogue at the end. And I promise it won't be death by PowerPoint. So great to meet everyone. Jason Gunderson, CEO of Cardio One. Norm's going to drive slides for me, so I'll click to the next slide. I thought it'd be beneficial to give a little bit of my background. People often ask me how I went from being training in rural family medicine to being the CEO of a private equity-backed company. But quick background on my journey. I've worked in all different parts of healthcare. Spent the first part of my career, actually I was at UMass from 2000 to 2010. I did my residency and I stayed there. I was an academic hospitalist, division chief, and built and launched a significant hospital medicine program for UMass. And did my MBA at UT at that time. I was a couple of years post-residency building and growing a hospitalist program. And it was my first taste of entrepreneurship before I knew I was going to be an entrepreneur. And really was encouraged by some alumni. Bruce Meyer, who was an alumnus from UT before me, was the president of the medical group at UMass, and I talked about it. And I really wanted to understand how to solve for the economics, the strategy, and really be able to speak the language of healthcare. So that's why I did my MBA. Had a good time at UMass, figured out I wasn't an academic, got recruited to Team Health, which is one of the largest physician management platforms in the country. I know several alumni from here. Had a chance to work with Chuck Noon, Jody Crane, Kate, bunch of folks there. But I had a number of roles there, started off as chief medical officer and finished up as president of hospitals and post-acute services. Was there during the public time and private equity owned time. Decided after a good time at Team Health that I wanted to experience a little bit more on the payer side. So I worked at a company called CareCentrix, doing utilization management and care in the home. I had the title of chief medical officer, but I really ran all clinical operations. PE-backed company was a good time there. I learned that I really didn't want to be strictly on the payer side. That company was acquired by Walgreens. And then I did a short time at Navis Healthcare as in population health as the chief performance officer. And fundamentally, I landed where I am today when Redesign Health, which was a venture studio in New York, wanted to build a physician enablement platform focused on independent, focused on cardiologists and ultimately moving them into value-based care. And then I just joined up there a little over 2 years ago as a CEO and co-founder, and going to tell you a little bit of the journey about us here at Cardio One. It's kind of a fun story. I like to tell this. 2 years ago, there were four Cardio One employees, and we had no live practices. A year ago, we were growing pretty well, and we went out and launched a Series A fundraise. And today, there's 138 Cardio One employees, 37 clinicians live on the platform, having it all hands with the whole team. We've been acquired by a private equity firm this past winter, and it's been a crazy ride with growing and building and having a lot of fun. So let me click over and I'll talk to you a little bit about Cardio One, and then we'll answer some questions. You know, we'll leave it open for dialogue and questions. So Cardio One is a physician enablement platform built specifically to support independent cardiologists in today's difficult fee-for-service environment, but really building the tools that will help them capitalize on the future of value-based care. I like to use the term solve for today and build for tomorrow. A lot of people are very skeptical of value-based care, as well they should be. We've been talking about it for a long time and we've had trouble moving there. But in many cases where people have entered into risk arrangements or some type of value arrangement, people have had difficulty. And that's because we really haven't solved for the basics of today. Access is a terrible problem. If any of you are cardiologists or have tried to get an appointment with a cardiologist, you will wait months. And so while we solve for those issues today, like access, in-office testing, that solves for issues in today's fee-for-service environment, but it really preps our physicians to be able to move into more larger risk arrangements. Next slide, Norm, please. I know many of you are clinicians and physicians on this call, but cardiovascular disease is number one cause of death in the United States. We've really not moved the needle on this. I was a hospitalist for a long time. We all know that heart failure is the number one cause of readmissions for Medicare patients, with almost one in four patients being readmitted within 30 days. So it's a significant area, and we really haven't, we've built out value arrangements in areas such as renal, oncology, musculoskeletal, primary care. We really haven't focused on it on the cardiology side, and we just think it's a tremendous opportunity. Next slide, please. So if you look at just the addressable market for where we're trying to move forward, significant medical spend under management in cardiology today, when you look at kind of the value opportunity, about $320 billion. We see that growing over the next 10 plus years to be a $750 billion opportunity. On the right-hand side, you'll see total number of independent physicians. So I will tell you 80% of cardiologists are employed. I'm a little controversial when I say things. I would say 80% of cardiologists are probably not very happy in their roles. And so about 10,000 independent cardiologists exist in the market today. Two-thirds of those are in practices of 10 or less. Two-thirds of those are in practices of one to three. So we felt significant opportunity. And when we first launched the business, we were focused solely on working with currently independent docs to help them, you know, navigate the environment that they're in today. But I will tell you, and we'll talk about it a little bit farther down the line, we've been able to see the movement out of employment into private practice. So we think over the next 7+ years, we're going to see an increase in the number of independent cardiologists as we move forward. Next slide, please. One of the biggest things I like to point out when talking about this opportunity is there's a lot of dollars spent when you look at it from a value standpoint and cost to the healthcare ecosystem in this little thing called hospital outpatient department. And I'm sure that I have many hospital colleagues on the phone, but if you just look at the total reimbursement costs, and I won't jump through these, of what can be done in a hospital outpatient department versus moving to an ambulatory surgical center, or moving things like cardiac PET from a hospital outpatient to an ambulatory setting, substantial savings. And so we think there's a very conservative case just to move those procedures out of HOPDs into ambulatory, or out of hospitals into ambulatory surgical centers. And that will just be an opportunity to save significant dollars. You know, we see, you know, billions in savings in terms of moving people out of those environments. And so that's what we really set out to do, is we think that there is a lot of viability in the private practice world. It's lower costs. Our practices have much better access. And I've really seen a lot more satisfaction on the physician side. So let me click over and tell you a little bit about our team. When we launched, we put together a team, which I think is really some of the best in the industry. And we've put together a group that have really kind of grown out of other successful launches. So Dan, our CFO, was employee, I think, 4 at Village MD. JP led the specialty rollout at Walmart Health. Alex was actually at Redesign Health and helped come up with the idea around Cardio One and actually helped hire me. So it's been great to have him on board. Really strong leadership team built on solving for the challenges, having worked in value-based care, having worked in physician management, having worked in fee-for-service, bringing all those skills together to try to really help move our physician practices forward. I'll click one slide forward. So let me tell you a little bit about us. So we were launched by Redesign Health. We had a phenomenal first year. We went out to do a fundraise and were acquired by Windrose Health Investors. And so they've been an unbelievable partner to work with in terms of support. You'll hear a lot about PE. PE is very much, and I'll take a little, put a little pause for a second. PE is very much in the news right now, and not in a good way. Lots of issues around Stewart and some of the other cases of PE-backed firms being challenged. And that's really around sort of the PE roll-up model where, you know, physicians get bought and continue to roll. Windrose is not a PE roll-up model. We are not a PE roll-up model. We do not buy practices. We do not own practices. We do not pay physicians. So I do point out that it's somewhat funny when I talk about it because we're an anti-PE PE company. So, but it's given us a significant amount of capital for us to invest and grow the team and really have a strong partner to build the platform that you'll see as we go forward. Something else I'm really proud of, I mean, I think having a physician CEO has resonated with our physician partners. It's allowed people to, you know, I had to practice and use EMRs, and so a lot of the build we've done have been, you know, based on a lot of my experience. We're also physician-led at the board level. So John Gavras is a pulmonary critical care doc, a former Florida Blue leader, and he is our board chair. So great team that we're working with. I just put a little plug in for them because they've been phenomenal partners as we go forward. Let me click over to the next slide. So a little bit of our model, right? So first of all, most of the time when I talk about this with people, people say independent doctors, like I didn't really think that those existed anymore, right? Because everybody's been either rolled up into a health system or into someone like Optum, who people, you know, Optum's the largest employer of physicians in the United States. So there are independent docs out there, but being an independent doc is very difficult. If you look on the left, they basically, in addition to just being the doc, you are also the practice manager, hiring manager, bookkeeper, contractor, and the rest. So what we've done is we've built a model that will allow us to go out and really build and scale these businesses at a very rapid level. So we have our get out of the market. So we do everything we can around building and launching a program. We do credentialing, enrollment, implementations. We can help with financing, basically anything you need to kind of like get the business started. Once we get going, we have our practice optimization team, which is really about bringing in operational excellence, recruitment, managing rev cycle, technology. And then we have our practice performance area, which is how do we build and grow those businesses? So that's things around just helping to grow the business. Simple things like social media and website development. We add on clinician recruitment. We add on imaging. And then we get into big growth accelerators. And those are some of the more sophisticated areas, which are really around things like ambulatory surgical center builds, advanced imaging, things like PET and CT angios, care coordination, and then payer conversations around how we can do that. And so what we tell people is that if you're an independent doc, you're trying to do all this on your own, we are essentially the one-stop shop. Our practices join us. We handle everything. I like to say you practice medicine, we'll take care of the rest. We will handle everything to help support the practice. So a physician that works with us gets to have the benefit of owning their own tax ID number, maintaining their independence, but getting the support and scale of a national organization without having to sell. It's resonated very, been a strong resonance with the market right now. And we've had a very robust pipeline and a lot of growth. We'll click over to the next slide, talk a little bit more about kind of our capabilities. And so we have kind of the front end and then the enablement platform. I'll talk about the right side. Those are our six core pillars, and that's how we built the business. So we have our own technology platform. We're not a technology company. We are a people and services company. So we have a great tech platform, which I'll elaborate on in another slide. We have our practice optimization program, which is how do we get the best out of our technology? I like to say having great technology without training is like having a really fast car and not knowing how to drive it. We've all seen those YouTubes of someone that gets rich and goes out and buys a Lamborghini and drives it into a concrete wall. It's probably an extreme version, but it's really about how do we optimize the program. We have a growth engine, which covers everything. To help that practice be successful, they are competing against large health systems. So this is website, search engine, everything that goes into it. We do all the payer contracting relationship. We have a whole staff management team who will hire in and bring in every staff member you would need, handle all the recruitment, training, HR management, payroll, and the rest. And then what we call is our value-based care tool development, which is things around how do we bring in-office testing at a lower cost and more convenient to patients, things like some of our practices may not have echo capability or PET or SPECT. We bring all these tools in. We have enhanced services around care coordination, remote patient monitoring, and the rest. The Box on the left really is something that's developed pretty aggressively over the last 6 or 7 months. When we went out to market, like I said, we were thinking about it from working with currently independent physicians and helping them. But we have been inundated with employed physicians who want to reclaim their independence. I like to say we liberate them from their employment agreements. And so they've come and said, we really want to have our own practice. We want to be able to dictate the types of patients we see, the time that we spend, our clinical interests. We want to build our own equity and ownership in our practice. You know, we just want to have control over it. You know, we're kind of fed up and burned out. So we have a platform that will help them handle everything to get that program launched. That's everything from real estate and architecture design, capital support and financing to do, you know, move things forward. We have a project management team. We do all the recruitment and training for onboarding. We handle payer relationships and contracting. And then obviously the big interest in a lot of folks moving out is, how do I move into my own practice so I can either have my own ambulatory surgical center or office-based lab, and then advanced imaging as we get moving forward. So we've really built this new practice platform that's moving, and that's probably the biggest area of growth for us as we go forward. We'll click on to the next slide. Everybody likes to talk about technology. I'm a technology person myself. Clearly, we're using great technology to run a podcast with people all over the country. Our platform is called Rhythm. It's built on an Athena core, and it's fully customized with everything that a physician, clinician, because we do work with nurse practitioners and PAs, need to have in one click. Nothing drove me crazier, and I know my clinician colleagues on the call will know this, like someone saying, oh, use this widget, log in over here. You're like, I'm never logging in over there. There's too many things to do. So Athena is our core. Everything in the purple are kind of parts of Athena that we've customized. We handle all the data migration and setup for an existing practice, build out everything, fully cover it so the practices don't have to deal with it. Everything in black are things we've kind of added on that are customized. So things like PACS, imaging, remote patient monitoring. We now do ambient AI scribe technology, data migration. We have data warehouses, custom dashboards, everything that sits on top of it. It's really been a great platform for our physicians in terms of efficiency. One of our first practices reclaimed a day and a half of patient care time because we've been able to take on all the duties that she was formerly doing in terms of hiring and recruitment, bill payment, staff management, and the rest. And they've seen a pretty significant uptick in terms of probably about an 80% reduction in documentation time using our platform. Let me move on to tell you the story that I'm probably that's been the most exciting is we work with a great group of clinicians in New Hampshire, cardiovascular specialists of New England. They were a fully employed group of 9 cardiologists and 3 APCs. Within that group of 9 cardiologists, 5 were interventional and 4 were EPs. And they made a decision that they really wanted to go out and be independent. And so they've worked for CMC for decades, have built a huge patient panel, but decided to leave and move forward. And we were introduced to them in February. I flew up there and had dinner with them. We put the whole plan together and kicked off. We signed our contract in April, and then we kicked off implementation. And so we handled everything to launch the practice, from hiring local leadership, hiring all the staff, helping them make sure all the financing was done. We were 94% contracted about a month and a half prior to go live. So we're actually able to schedule patients before the go live. So when they started, they had a panel, hired folks, everybody was up and running. And we set a launch date of September 3rd. And on September 3rd, that practice launched 2 buildings and are off and running. They have full capabilities on site. Absolute pleasure to work with. A great story of folks out there. They've actually published some. If you see on my LinkedIn post or the Cardio One LinkedIn post, you'll see posts from both our team and their team about the journey to kind of movement into independence. Let me just click over onto the next slide. And this basically is, you know, we put our money where our mouth is. You'll see in the first 2 months, they had a pro forma for where they wanted to be. They've exceeded practice revenue and EBITDA in the first 2 months. And they have a patient panel of almost 4,800 patients in the first 2 months of being live. So, super successful group, proud to partner with them, looking to replicate this in models across the country. A couple big things on go live. We were in network with every payer contract that they wanted to have. We had hired 53 staff members to up and run the program. done all the marketing. We hired all the laptops. If you think about things like that, I like to tell stories. My wife was listening to me talk about ordering like soap and toilet paper. And she's like, what are you doing? I'm like, we're opening an office. We had to get everything in an office to run. And that included getting everything in the door, like pens, and to make sure the bathrooms were stocked. So awesome story of where they are at something we're hoping to replicate and move forward. And let me move on to the next slide. I'll talk a little bit about the Solve for Today, Build for Tomorrow. So very interested in kind of talking about that Solve for Today, Build for Tomorrow. So how do we get in there and basically stabilize the practice, get all the components in there around access, get the technology in place, move into kind of growing the business, just really enable lower cost sites of care. All that makes money in today's fee-for-service environment, but are really critical to move into Build for Tomorrow. And now we're kicking off the conversations with payers around how do we bring this a step further, because we see that it's lower cost site of care saves money to the healthcare ecosystem. We're seeing physicians be happier. So we're really in the Build for Tomorrow. Actually, have a busy day today. We have our exec team in town. So we're doing our all hands meeting with our staff, which has grown quite substantially. We have a payer meeting today with a large payer. It's actually our second conversation. Very interested in what we can do to help them move forward, kind of the value side, and reduce some of the costs to the patient and the healthcare system. So big day for us, lots going forward. And then I'll just kind of show you where we are and where we're growing towards on the next slide. And then happy to answer questions. So you can see 2022, at this point, we had signed 4 clinicians. Right now, we have 37 signed, hoping to sign another 32 by the end of the year, and doing another, what we call de novo, which is just like that, taking an employed group into private and get that signed hopefully this week. So with that, I think that was my last slide, and just appreciate the chance to tell our story, and happy to answer questions or talk about the Cardio One journey or how I went from a family doc working in a federally qualified community health center to CEO role. A lot of people ask me about that because, you know, moving physicians into those roles always been it's always a little bit of a challenge to get recognized as you move forward. So appreciate the time. And Norm, however you want to handle questions, I saw some pop up as we go forward.
This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. So we'll just move into some of the questions here. So the first question we got was from Don, and it was just a little bit about the average size practice. You mentioned your first practice was a nine member practice. But what about the other practices that you brought on board? What's the average size that find you attractive?
We run 1 to 12 right now, and are talking to groups as large as 24. Most of the groups that are, there's very few, first of all, there's like almost very, very few groups left that are north of 20 that haven't been acquired by a couple of the other PE roll-up models. So when we went out, we thought our average group size was going to be about 3. We're now running about 4.5 right now. We think 25 is going to still be around 5, but we're seeing that number grow. If I had to tell you, I think the sweet spot is about 10 to 12 in terms of being able to get alignment and move things forward. For those of you that manage large groups of physicians, a group of 24 physicians is very hard to get them all to agree on to do one thing. So I think, you know, our sweet spot is probably that 10 to 12 is what we really like to do. Mm. And that's where we're seeing a lot of growth. But we are seeing growth into the 20s now. So if that's the answer, that probably answers it. But it was 3 when we started. We're at about 4.5 now. We think that number is going to creep up as we sign more of these kind of employed to private transitions, which will probably be running more in the 10 to 12 range.
What percentage of the practice or what percentage of the physicians that you have brought on board have transitioned from an employed model to an independent model versus helping groups remain independent? How's that ratio looking right now?
Right now, it's about 2/3 independent, staying independent, and mm-hmm. then 1/3 of the total provider count are employed to privates. I would say, and the go forward, I would say that that's growing to be 50-50. It will probably swing more towards the employed to privates as we go forward.
Okay. And then Don asked another question, which I was going to ask as well. So most PE firms have a return on investment. How does Cardio One generate that ROI for the investors?
So we do that by growth. It's a growth-oriented firm. So as we are able to grow the total number of practices we work with, that's growth. We then grow those practices that are signed up. I will tell you that our first two practices that signed in January are running 37 and 44% growth in monthly net revenue. So we grow the business, generates revenue for a return for the investors. And we're really looking towards how do we build the scale, move into risk arrangements with payers to lower total cost of care, because we feel we can do it in a much faster and easier way. If you just think about it, trying to get a large health system to sign up for something, you've got to get hundreds of doctors from multiple specialties on board. We can move very quickly. Our fastest contract, which was 10 clinicians, went first meeting to execution in just over 3 weeks. So smaller groups that move very quick, very nimble. Health systems, we all know, they're big, lots of bureaucracy, so slower. So the return on investment is we grow the business, we move into risk, we can demonstrate to payers that we can lower total cost of care, improve patient outcomes, and that really is where the return is. We're not buying a practice. The other thing is we haven't bought a practice, so we don't have a huge equity investment that we have to earn back. So if you were to buy a practice, you put a big multiple on that practice, you have to earn all that back and then a return on top of it. We don't have that capital outlay, so it makes the return on investment much faster.
So is your contract with the groups, is it more like a practice management agreement? Is it based on a percentage of revenue? Is it based on a percentage of growth or visits? How do you usually
structure that? We base it simply on a percent of revenue. So we contract directly with the physicians on a percent of revenue. Pretty simple model.
Okay. So it's basically an expense for them, just like it would be if they hired any practice management company.
Yep, except we roll everything together. And So there's savings for working with us in terms of we buy at scale. So instead of having a contract with one EMR and then go to Medtronic to buy this and Octagos to do your device monitoring or cardio diagnostics to get your components, that's always how things come together. So we buy them all at scale. So it becomes actually cheaper from an expense standpoint. So yeah, that's kind of how we've been driving the model there. And then there's obviously the growth return where we're able to help by allowing the physician to focus on doing clinical work and not doing all this non-clinical business administration. We're able to really drive revenue growth. So that drop expenses and improve revenue. So improves margin.
Great. I'm going to move on to a question from Mark Drumhiller. Mark, thanks for your question. The question, and you can probably, I think you can see this on your screen, can't you, Jason?
I can.
I don't know if everybody needs me to read the questions. I feel like I'm an elementary school teacher.
Non-competes. The topic, it's such a hot topic right now. Yes and no. So a couple things that I would talk about. So first, non-competes are a hot issue in today's regulatory environment. So for those of you familiar with Lina Khan and the FTC shot at non-competes, that has raised a lot of noise in the market. And it's made people a little bit reluctant. You don't want to be on the cover of the New York Times or on CNN for suing a bunch of doctors for non-compete in today's environment. So I think people are becoming a little bit more, and I'm not saying that hospitals are suddenly going to be reasonable about it, but it is a politically charged environment to do that. One, two, for those of you that are interested in independent work, there is a great group called American Independent Medical Practice Association. I want to put a plug in for them. I sit on the board. Last August, that group came together to support the role of independent physicians in the market. Now represents over 11,000 physicians from 17 specialties, published a number of papers on this, and do a lot of regulatory work. But I just want to put a plug in for those physician leaders out there, a great group to look at, doing some phenomenal work. Non-competes are a challenge, right? So you're going to run into them. They're market dependent on how aggressive they are. But I think that there is a path forward to have a cooperative agreement and co-management arrangement with the hospital that is mutually beneficial to both parties and to patients. That doesn't mean that hospitals don't freak out about them. What we've done is approach those. So two things, we're not taking their employed doctors and then buying them and employing them ourselves. So we're a little bit less threatening. These doctors are leaving to go do something independent. We're just there to support them. We do work very hard to be cooperative with our hospital partners around co-management arrangements, you know, staying on staff, using those hospitals for procedures that need to be done in hospitals, inpatient rounds, heart failure clinics, and the rest. So I do think that there is a path forward that we need to get away from this like hyper-competitive, you know, restrictive, you can't do this, you can't do that. Why a hospital has to own everybody doesn't make a whole bunch of sense. You have to look at your market, you have to look at your restrictive covenant and see how those work. What we've done is, in the partner practices where we've done this, it's been a little bit more politically amenable in that market than one of our competitors did one in Florida. Florida is a very rough state to go after. Very, very competitive. So I think you have to look through those and then work through what we need to do with the different, for, you know, how to work through that. It's an art, not a science. It's about negotiation. It's about trying to find what's the best path forward and how we support each other as we think about non-competes. But they come up, we look at them, we do adhere to all the legal requirements that are in those around not violating those or violating non-solicits. But we've been very successful in how we're doing those and continue to work on those going forward. I think the environment's a little bit more tolerant right now. Plus, hospitals are also under a lot of financial pressure. And so we were able to kind of, I think, be a supportive environment for those as we go forward.
So the next question we have is from Sid. Sid, thank you for your question. Talk a little bit about the AI impact that you envision.
It's interesting. AI is like the hot topic for everything right now. So we are currently, our first path on AI is we're using ambient AI scribes. In our practice in New Hampshire, we just rolled them out. So we use DeepScribe. It's been fantastic. The docs there will tell you it's a game changer. So very interested to see how we can take this modality and move it forward. So AI in scribe technology, I think, is pretty interesting. It'll be interesting to see how much it can develop in a lot of the revenue cycle component, specifically around E&M coding, prior auth, eligibility verification. So we'll see where all that starts to come together. So optimistic about where it comes to. I will tell you, we get inbounds from companies right and left asking us to look at their different companies. DeepScribe's been a great first path. We're going to continue to work forward on that and then see how we can make sure that one is the AI company solving a problem that we have? Like, what's the problem we're trying to solve and then using it going forward? So it's definitely on the radar. DeepScribe's our first path forward. And we'll continue to move it as we go forward.
Do you have a sense on how the AI and use of clinical tools and large language models is going to be implemented, at least as it's relative to cardiology practices?
Yeah, I think it's just going to be about how we can, you know, how much AI can we use to, one, streamline the workflow. So that's, I think, the kind of base kind of fee-for-service use case, which is how do I use those models to make the doctors more efficient instead of sitting clicking away. Second, I think, you know, the ability for the AI companies to abstract data and use those large language models to understand like risk scoring, even something like HCCs, how do I identify patients with risk factors? What do I have to do to drive those issues forward? So I think it's first, like, how do I make the doctors more efficient? Second, how do I make the clinical care more efficient, either in terms of documentation, patient identification for high-risk patients, and even things like prior auth. Like, if we know we're going to order a test, could the AI not kind of read the note and say, oh, you didn't document X, Y, and Z in order to get the prior auth approved? So I think that's where we'll see AI move forward, kind of clinical documentation, risk scoring, and then kind of this revenue cycle eligibility authorization side.
Great. Thank you. Another question, what does CardioOne's future look like in terms of other medical specialties? Don asked a question about whether you're considering expanding into providing the same service in other specialties.
We get asked this question, I think, on a daily basis. We could replicate the model. We are not looking at doing that right now. One, we're very focused on all the tools and technology around cardiology. It, like I said, number one cause of death, tons of runway. So there's not a they need to move outside of that. And I think diluting the mission of it would not be a good idea right now. So we're very focused on, I would say, cardiovascular. Like, we will do some peripheral vascular work and stay in that swim lane. I just think that there's so much we could do there that we're just heads down on it. But it, you know, it could, I could see a model where we'd move it out. I do think it, being that we are a cardiology specific company, we resonate with the cardiologists. I would poke it out there. One thing that I think has been challenging in terms of value-based care for cardiology, that's maybe not as much for oncology and renal. So like, if a patient needs dialysis, I'm like, well, I can't do dialysis. They got to go to, so it's easy to carve that out. And like, oncology drugs, I don't understand any of those, like, at all. They go to oncology. That's some heart failure and some AFib and some hypertension. Like, that kind of feels in my swim lane. And that's been the biggest challenge that we've seen out there in terms of value-based care, is like, it's part of primary care and how do we work those together? So I think we have to figure that out. And so I think keeping us clean on the cardiology side is also not threatening to the primary care doctors. So it's a good lane for us to be in.
We got another question from Dr. Bonsall, which I'll let you handle.
In a startup, it's all about revenue growth. Now, my investor colleagues want us to, you know, get cash flow positive and, you know, generate margin. But if you're launching a business, it's all about product market fit and market traction and growth. It's just, you have to grow. There is no way out of that. You will never get from a seed through a Series A without revenue growth. I mean, you could be super efficient, but if you're not growing revenue with a runway forward, you'll never make a Series A raise. So you have to really think of, I mean, you have to be judicious. So there's this very interesting, you know, we can have a long conversation one day about running a seed funded company where you think every minute of the day about your cash burn. You know, we got to our Series A, there were 8 members of the national team that got us to the Series A. So when we were doing a fundraise, I said to your question, people were like, well, who does that? Like, I finally was like, I'm like, the 4 of us, like the exact, like, this is who does that. We did everything. I mean, sales, everything under the sun. So in a seed company, you are very focused on your cash burn, because there's this, you have to grow the business before you run out of money. So you're always thinking about, like, what's the return on investment? Like, how much do I want to burn? How much can I do myself? It's bits and pieces of everything, friend, you can go get to kind of get the growth trajectory, and then you run behind it. So it's a very interesting way of working. It was an absolute sprint, is what I would say. Fun time, though. Never been in the curve there as we go forward.
And Don asked a question about the ratio of fee-for-service revenue versus value-based arrangement revenues.
Almost all fee-for-service right now, because people are having a very difficult time wrapping their brains around how to do cardiology value-based care, even from an episodic standpoint. So working with some ACOs in the early stages and then trying to build out models around how to move. To your point, I think episodics are where we will go first. So when people, first of all, I say value-based care, and it's a term that makes me a little crazy, and I think it probably makes everybody crazy, because it means, like, if we asked 100 people for a definition of value-based care, we're probably going to get 300, 400 answers. Value-based care is a continuum. It's all about getting paid for outcomes. And so we like to start off with, you know, driving the performance, showing that we can have the basics, like, what's our access? You know, our practices see patients on average 1 business day. I mean, that's kind of like how we work. So how do we open access? How do we get the performance we need? And then from there, you move into pay for performance. Pay for performance is upside downside, episodics, and then you get into more populations. I think cardiology is probably headed towards a runway of more on the episodic side, because it's easier to put together and it works along with the at-risk primary care group. Very open payer conversations. And that's been the big part of getting in the door, is showing payers what we can do in terms of reducing cost of care, improving outcomes. I would encourage you, if you haven't read the Avalier study that AMPA published, that looked at Medicare only, PE-backed and independent docs versus hospital employed. It's a pretty intriguing study, came out about 2 months ago. It's remarkable how much lower total cost of care is in not hospital settings. So it's a build-in process. We would like it to go faster, just a time thing.
I got a couple of questions here that we haven't really touched on yet that I would like to ask you about. So your pitch obviously is for keeping practices independent. And in this live stream and podcast series, I've talked with physicians who've been doing everything from concierge medicine to more traditional independent practices to being employed and working for large health systems. So what are you finding most cardiologists are using the term independence to mean?
Usually not employed by a health system is where most people are thinking of it. PE-backed MSOs, people still view as independent. And so that's like a couple of our CVA USA or US Heart and Vascular or some of the big ones out there. They're the more traditional PE roll-up where they buy 30% of your practice, everybody gets rolled up, you become an employee of the entity. I would say most people view, and then the AMPA docs, which is where I do a lot of work with, AMPA docs review is either independent, unaffiliated, or PE-backed type folks like us as the independent docs. And then the employee docs are usually, by and large, health systems. But I got to throw Optum in there, largest employer of physicians in the United States. So that's kind of the bifurcation of how people look at it, whether I work for a health system, whether I work for some other independent entity.
Okay.
We focus on independence being really independent, meaning you own your tax ID number. Like, I don't pay you. I'll give you advice, but we don't pay any doctors or NPs or PAs.
And I know you're fairly new in the marketplace right now. What kind of arrangements do you have contractually for physician practices, cardiology practices that find out that this model is not really working for them? What's the process for them to move along a different path?
So if someone were to work with us and want to exit?
Yeah.
So they own their own tax ID number. So if they needed to or wanted to do an exit, they would just roll. They would either stay on Athena. They would have to move on to their own version of Athena, but that's a quick data migration. And then all their contracts they own. So they then have to set up the entities to pay the staff, you know, get their own contracts with all the different folks along the way. We had a practice that we worked with early on and it just wasn't working for them. They wanted something different. And so we said, listen, we want people to work with us because it worked well and it wasn't kind of what they wanted ultimately. And so we helped unroll them and they went and just did it on their own. So that is the benefit of ours is if you own your entity and you own your contracts, it becomes much, you always own those. If you sell them to somebody else and then you want to leave, you have to come to someone like us or do it on your own and get your own new contracts and rebuild everything. So a little different in how we've done that.
So there's another question that just came in about the future of physician practices. What do you see in that regard? A push towards more higher percentage you mentioned early in your presentation for cardiology. You get a feeling that more people want to extricate themselves or remain independent.
I think more and more people are going to want to be independent. There's a few things that make me think that. One, I think generationally, I get a lot of exposure to but my wife's an assistant dean at the medical school. So I get a lot more, we talk about this a lot. I think, you know, generationally people are not as interested in being told these are the hours you have to show up to work. People are like the newer grads, I think we get approached by a ton of new grads that have an interest in like how they want to practice or they don't want to go into like a pure RVU model, you know, 4.5 days per week and, you know, all the components go with it. So I think there is an interest there. Two factors, I think, or maybe three, that could quickly accelerate this in a very, very big way. One is site neutrality. So if regulatory environment comes out and these, forgive me for being opinionated, but these insane HOPD bills go away, hospitals aren't going to be able to afford to pay everybody. And the fastest way they're going to cut costs is they're going to cut huge physician expense. I'm a little bit cranky about the HOPD because I thought I was pretty smart and understood healthcare. And I walked into a nice outpatient looking office here in Denver and had an echo. So for my friends out there, and they billed my insurance company $5,200.
Wow.
For an echo. And I paid $285 out of pocket. I could go to one of my cardiologists and pay cash for less than that. So one, I'll get off my soapbox. So HOP is crazy. So site neutrality will change things. Payer pressures around hospitals or payers wanting to do more of this. And there's a lot of this starting to pop up around the country where payers don't want to be held hostage to these crazy rates. So site neutrality, payers, and hospitals have terrible margins and are just struggling. And one day they're going to figure out, and we're already starting to see it, that they just can't afford it and they're not getting the return on investment. Someone told me once when we were doing our Series A fundraise, and I won't name the investor, but they're like, well, if you don't buy the practice, you can't control the physicians. And I laughed out loud, almost fell off my chair. I'm like, if you think buying the doctors and paying the doctors is going to control the doctors, you're nuts.
Yeah.
That is not how it works. So I think it's site neutrality, payer pressures, and hospitals figuring out, like, you know what? Paying doctors $75 an RVU or whatever I'm paying them is like, I heard it. And they're not good at managing their money. So I think that there's going to be a shift between people getting kind of burned out of it. And I think physicians have traded long-term equity and ownership and long-term value in their career for a guaranteed paycheck up front.
Yeah.
And there's a big difference in that. It's, yeah, you're guaranteed a salary up front as long as the hospital is making a margin. But if that hospital is not making a margin, they will cut your salary. You own your business. You own your business. You create long-term, an employed physician builds a huge patient panel, thousands of patients. Yeah, they go there because the hospital's named on it, but they go to see Norm or Jason or Don or Sid. There's value there. And so I think all those things coming together as people start to figure out, I think if you look at the consolidation in cardiology, I'm getting old now, but like when I was a resident 20 plus years ago, it was like 20 or 30% consolidated. It has exploded. I think we over-exploded it, and most specialties will start to swing back. We'll always be hospital-employed, but I think people will start to find a middle ground. So yes, I'm very optimistic. I'm obviously optimistic about it because I'm out there driving the mission around moving towards independence. But we're going to have to help physicians. You'll need entities like us to help them because it's just too hard to do.
Yeah, thanks for that. Well, I want to pivot a little bit right now. We're kind of winding down. We got about 10 minutes left in the show. You mentioned in your presentation that you had a mentor who kind of encouraged you to pursue an MBA at a time when you were working with a large organization in Massachusetts as leading their hospitalist program. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how you found that experience, number one. And number two, as your role changed through many other different roles, working for Team Health and then going to CareCentrix and Navis Health and now on the capital equity side and sort of working in this brand new area for you. Have you found that the MBA has given you residual value and that it's still as you're still using that information in the same way that you were back in 2007?
Yeah, I use it every day. So when I went to do it, I like to tell the story around, like, you know, one day the department chair of family medicine came to me and said, hey, could you start a hospitalist program? And I was like, because I'd been doing a lot of hospital work and I really liked it. And I almost went to a competitor to work for them. And I was like, sure. So my wife's like, what do you know about that? So I like called all my friends and figured out how to do revenue projection and figured out what a pro forma was and was, we had a really good launch. Things went really well. And then I was trying to figure out, like, I knew at some point I needed to learn how to speak the business language because y'all know you go to the hospital administrator. I was in a hospital at the time, right? Go to the hospital administrator. They talk in circles and you're like, it's kind of like hide the money a little bit. So I really wanted to understand the language so that I could demonstrate return on investment and go with cohesive arguments. Like everyone loves to come to me and be like, I need resources. I'm like, just tell me how much money it is because resources just means dollars. So I went and did it. And it really, I think I did my OAP on this redesign of the UMass hospitalist program. And so I kind of did it all at the same time. So it was great. I mean, it worked out fantastic. I mean, grew that business and then learned how to work in a bunch of other environments. I mean, obviously the finance and the technical, you know, budgeting side of it was really helpful. But the leadership development side of it, I think, is what people need to pay the most attention to. That's probably what I do the soft side. I hate to say the soft side, but like the work you do around your own leadership development and understanding your strengths, weaknesses, skills, how you relate to people and get people on board. You can have that, like you could be the smartest person in the room, but if you cannot convince everybody to do what you want them to do, it is a useless idea. So it's all those things that came together that was really very helpful for me. And then honestly, the network was really helpful. I ended up at Team Health because of networks via the Pemba Group. And so, you know, we had a bunch of my docs when I was at Team Health do the program too. So it worked really well. I use it all the time. It's interesting. Someone asked me about like what, you know, what programs to do. Like I'm not going to be a CFO. Like I was a doc, like I'm going to be the, like be in a leadership position. I'm going to go back and like redo all the finance stuff. Like I have a CFO. I have to be able to communicate with my CFO. So I think that that's what I think that like physicians that are moving into those roles have to do. You have to, like, you're not going to be this, I mean, maybe you want to be, but you're not really going to head down that path. You're going to end up in one of these leadership components. And how you can translate, I like to say I like to translate for my CFO, because sometimes they talk and I'm like, they'll give a report out to like the team. And I'm like, okay, in English, that means this. So I use it all the time. I mean, I think the leadership skills are something that people probably don't, that's the biggest component, is getting everybody on board and building a team and retaining a team and understanding how to drive, you know, hiring, like also figuring out things that you are not good at or don't like to do, and hiring people that like to do those things. That's like the sweet spot.
What would you say, and maybe it was the leadership skills, but what was the least anticipated benefit of completing your MBA? The thing that just kind of caught you off guard that you had no idea that you would get value from?
It was probably the leadership assessments and those skills, and trying to do the deeper dive on like where you were really good and where you had opportunities. I thought I would do the finance, and I thought I would do the strategy, and I thought I would do kind of the marketing stuff like that. I figured the leadership development side and the networking was the side that I probably didn't anticipate. And it's the most highly valued part of what I do. And I will tell people that, like, you know, for those out there that haven't done it, but if you're going to go out and look for bigger and bigger jobs, they're going to put you through some type of evaluation. Like I've been through some of them multiple times. Like I've gone through one, I'm like, the Hogan, I'm like, I've done it before. I can just send it to you. You don't need to spend the money. Like, so having done those and understanding those aspects is really important, because, you know, people use them for understanding hiring and fit. I personally have had a coach now. I've had the same coach for 8 years, who I've worked with at Team Health, CareCentrics, Navis, and now Cardio One. And she actually works with me, with my team, and we do Hogan assessments on all the senior management. We do 360s at a year, and we've had nobody resign in 2 years. And I think that's just some of those skills, like, you know, building your team and having people on board is like the most important part of it. I can only be in so many places at the same time. It's a big team effort. And honestly, the part I like about my job the most is actually helping, you know, promoting members of my team and seeing them grow into positions along the way. Like we're going to announce 2 big promotions today. It's the fun part.
That is fun. Well, before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you too, are there any other thoughts or comments that you'd like to share with the viewers before we end?
Yeah. So this is an interesting thing. For those of you that out there that want to be in like the CEO type seats, which I think a lot of people do, ask yourself why. Some days I'm like, why did I want to do this to myself? But I'm kidding, because I do love it. But it was a hard battle. And I will tell you, it was an uphill push for people to understand that as a physician, we could be in that role. I think we're seeing more and more physician CEOs, and people want us to be in those roles. Don't get frustrated by it. Network with everybody. Use any opportunity you can to understand economic strategy and growth. Like those are the three drivers of what CEOs do. Like I'm not a finance guy. I don't do clinical stuff. I mean, I wade into it dangerously a little bit, but CEOs do strategy, they drive growth, they got to understand the numbers, and they got to be able to build a team and drive a cohesive vision. Those are the four skills you'll need to build and have your proof points, and you can never turn down networking. So I will tell you, I worked with a recruitment firm. I think she was like one of the, like, just kind of getting started, junior, there, and we've always stayed in touch. And here and there, I've looked at jobs and I've turned down jobs, and I've networked to help them hire people. And then one day she called me up out of the blue and was like, this is the job. And it was great. And so the networking is super important. I will tell you, I needed to hire a chief operating officer. And the first person I called was Julia, who placed me in my role at Oxyon. And she just placed our COO. So networking drives the whole thing. But for those of you out there that have done this and want to be in the bigger roles, networking, focusing on those areas are the key components. You guys, anybody can reach me on LinkedIn. I answer, you'll be surprised, like I answer so many notes on LinkedIn. And if building the network is so important, because you'll never know, you'll like have a question and be like, oh, you have someone to call. So build your network, think about those components, don't get frustrated. There's a ton of opportunity out there and interest.
And we'll post your LinkedIn contact information in the on the YouTube channel as well. So a couple of the other references that you made, I'll touch base with you after so I can
I'll send those along to you. The AMPA and the Avalier study is fascinating. And it was commissioned on 5. There's another round of papers that are going to come out on the commercial side, but the Avalier study is published now and pretty wild.
Great. Well, Jason, thanks so much for taking your time.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of PEMBA On Demand, taken from our live stream on November 19th, 2024. Dr. Gunderson presented fascinating information regarding the value of independent physician practices, cardiology practices in our healthcare system. PEMBA On Demand podcasts are released bi-monthly every other Thursday. Please join us in 2 weeks on December 12th, 2024. I will be interviewing Dr. Michael Marks in an episode entitled Leadership Odyssey, Bridging Medicine and Business. We look forward to having you join us for that episode.
That wraps up our show for today. Thank you very much for joining and listening to the podcast. If you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to add them in the comment section on our website, tiny.utk.edu/POD podcast. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to the website below. Please also don't forget to subscribe to the podcast by clicking the subscribe button. Add PEMBA On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could leave a review of the podcast on your podcast player. Share the podcast with your friends and colleagues also. Please take good care of yourselves, and as always, good luck with your future.